our AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deep dive and talk about the issues that you want to hear about from guests that you want to hear from. And one of the big topics that everybody is excited about, I think, for the Trump mandate is all of the talk around the economy. There are so many great things that the Trump campaign promised, and now Trump, while he is in office, is suggesting that he will accomplish, especially with DOGE, trying to claw back a lot of this reckless spending. And will that be distributed to taxpayers? Might we all receive a refund potentially? But what about tariffs? And what about actually codifying some of these wins? What about the judiciary with us trying to stop and thwart these executive orders? And what about the thing that we all care most about, of course, which is getting rid of the income tax? I mean, all of these things on the economy as a whole are really fascinating. So let's get some perspective from Tho Bishop, our guest for this deep dive today, who is the outreach director at the Mises Institute, a paleo-libertarian, as he describes himself on his X profile. You should follow him at Tho Bishop, but also, and most importantly, Florida man. So Tho, thanks so much for joining me today. And as a Florida man, your perspective on the economy and the broader issues that we need to consider in, I think, kind of a topic that is very difficult right now to pin down into specific policy.
As a Florida man, I'm very excited to be in a state that has very low spending. I think it's the lowest per capita of any state in the country, a very good tax environment that they're looking to make lower, and just a very friendly relative climate for business in general. It's definitely a testament to strong state leadership and the impact that that can have. But nationally, I think it's a very interesting sort of period of general uncertainty right now. Donald Trump definitely campaigned on and I think had an electoral mandate on very big changes that were desperately needed when it came to spending and the DOGE efforts, when it came to reining back the regulatory state, hacks at the larger administrative state, and the like. And what we're seeing is, for one, just the real structural problem that America has that we all suffer from is the very clear demonstration that it is so much easier to grow the government, to grow the state, than it is to reduce it. And we're seeing this in a number of ways. We're seeing it with the challenges through the legislative process and the budgeting process and the frustration that conservatives have in having spending cuts and DOGE cuts codified within that process. We're seeing it with the judicial system that seems like it's trying to strike down every executive order, many of which are very good and are targeted for that reduction. We have an additional layer of uncertainty when it comes to trade policies and its connection with broader foreign policy, the heightened tensions between the Trump administration and Europe and the EU as a whole, trade relations with Canada and Mexico. How do those negotiations go in terms of, to what extent are tariffs a means to an end? Is it a better way to improve trade and all the factors that go into American industry through that? Are they a means to an end? Is it a means of helping offset income tax receipts? Well, then that's a question there. Is it a truly protectionist dynamic on bringing manufacturing in? That is an open question, and kind of depending on the day, you get different rhetoric from the administration on what the end is there. And so right now we have, this is uncertainty is better than effective, deliberate economic policy designed to grow the state, which is certainly what we got in the Biden administration and, the various New Deal projects and the spending programs and things like that. So uncertainty is better than what we had. But I think there's a lot of frustration, both from the administrative point of view, and that we should recognize as people that want to see the real world consequences of, the Trump economic mandate come to be, the extent to which the state itself is fighting back against the executive branch, and just this broader curtain of uncertainty that makes kind of the necessary reforms necessary, a difficult environment to navigate right now.
Yeah, and you bring in, though, a lot of different factors, and while citizens are very excited, and certainly conservatives, that Trump is going to hopefully renew the economy and have some of these things like the economy was in his first term before, of course, COVID and that whole disaster. All of these things are really complex. And you mentioned the judiciary thwarting a lot of executive orders. What are some examples of that? Because I think we've heard more in the news about some of the more hot button topics, like, you know, judges getting in the way of mass deportations and, you know, the Tren de Aragua flight, you know, some of those things. But I don't think there's been a ton of reporting, or at least in the mainstream, about some of these judges who are trying to thwart economic related EOs.
Well, I mean, everything ranging from, you know, the judicial rulings against DOGE cuts in certain departments, including USAID. You know, we know that challenges such as, you know, any executive agency that is seeking to reduce the size of their staff, radically overhaul regulatory policy, the EPA being a big example of that. I mean, it's now to the point where anything that is announced, you can expect some judge somewhere in the country putting a halt on it, which is going to lead to a massive backlog to the Supreme Court. And then there's a broader conversation about the Supreme Court's ruling in some of this. I know there's been some frustration with the rulings from Amy Coney Barrett in particular, in terms of that sort of stuff. And so that's kind of one of the larger problems, is that, you know, every time that we get, the structural problems of America have not changed. They've been in place for quite some time. We are overly regulated. We've got a gigantic professional political class. We have major issues when it comes to debt and spending. And, you know, just time and time again, any attempts at radical reform are stymied either through judges trying to co-opt the executive power in terms of the management of those departments, or them trying to rule that certain programs financed through the legislature must therefore be cut through the legislature. I'm not dismissing necessarily some of the legal arguments that go within that. There's very highly paid, very highly credentialed, you know, judges that can rationalize those viewpoints. But just from a purely economic perspective, the consequences of preventing the sort of bold, dynamic reform that is desperately needed in this country is only going to hurt and damage the economic well-being of American taxpayers.
Yeah, there are so many problems with the judiciary. And I had Steve Dace on recently on the morning show side, and he suggested that the solution, instead of, you know, these endless appeals and an overwrought judiciary and all this, the Trump administration needs to simply ignore some of these ridiculously, obviously unconstitutional attempts of the judiciary to get involved with purely political questions and authority that is actually vested in the executive in Article 2 that is not given to the judiciary in terms of review of everything. Because judicial review, I mean, talk about that a lot, but it only goes so far, even with Marbury versus Madison, and if we want to establish that whole line of precedent, there are still things that even judicial review would argue that the judiciary cannot contemplate, and really that falls under the political question doctrine. But basically it's that the judiciary doesn't make opinions on policy questions as long as the policy falls within the parameters of the power actually given to the agency that's trying to carry it out, or in this instance, the president, because executive power is vested in a president of the United States per Article 2, Section 1. So, you know, from a, I guess, a practical standpoint, and we're seeing that the left is using these judges to try to thwart good policy and constitutionally viable policy in a lot of different parameters, but especially the economy. Is that the solution, to simply go ahead anyway and say, you know, we'll have our day in court and all of that, but for the Trump administration to just kind of continue on exercising their legitimate authority under the Constitution and sort of ignoring these judges who are trying to create artificial obstacles?
I think that is the necessary case here, because it's important to, you know, I think there's a value in kind of not giving the current judicial class, I don't want to paint with an overly broad brush, but, you know, it's better, I think, understood almost from a, a more class analysis lens, which a lot of the early free market economists very much adopted. Marx kind of co-opted it with his own ways in that sort of regard. But prior to that, you had this very real recognition from a lot of the free market thinkers in America and England and abroad that recognize essentially that the class interest dynamic are those whose power come from the state and those from the productive class. And what we're seeing is, I think, more or less a careful governed doctrine of carefully factoring in judicial court of the various factors in a judicial ruling, rather than just a self-interest entrenchment trying to push back against an ideological agenda that will reduce the state that goes against the ideological desires of much of the judiciary. And I think a very interesting historical example for this, someone who certainly was not a believer in the notion of judicial supremacy, was the presidency of Andrew Jackson. And Jackson, various different elements of that presidency, obviously, and not all of them need to be litigated for this question, but it's interesting, if you look through American history, the period where you saw the greatest reduction of government spending power, et cetera, came through that Jacksonian period, not simply of Jackson himself, but of Martin Van Buren and John Tyler, which was interesting in its own right, and Polk. And what you saw was a massive reduction of the administrative state, of the actual workhorse, kind of a proto-doge, if you would, serious discussions about sound money, which kind of average workers in America during this period of industrialization recognized was benefiting the banker class at the expense of the working class. And so I think some of these core fundamental tenets, which might sound like overly ideological than sort of narrow economic policy, sort of typical sort of questions, are important because we have to recognize the extent to which, again, this elaborate state has been constructed. And so we can talk about little tweaks on the margins in terms of, maybe changing the way that we measure ideal inflation numbers from the Fed, or some minor reforms to regulatory bodies here or there. But it gets to this more profound question of, one, the ability of, who actually governs America, who sets the governing priorities for D.C.? Should the executive branch be able to set administrative branch policies when you have a big ideological shift there? What is the challenge that Congress has in terms of in any governing body where it's easier to spend $2 trillion in debt than it is to cut $2 trillion of debt, have very serious problems. And so these are very, very profound sentiments. And so I think it feeds to the anger and the frustration that led to Republicans embracing someone like Trump. And until we can hit at the core of these root problems that will always side with growing the D.C. at the expense of everyone around D.C., then we're still in a state of managed decline. And so, taking the bold steps necessary to make sure that some of these, executive orders focused on administrative policies in particular, I think are necessary, even if they become controversial in their input.
You mentioned congressional authority, and some of this just boils down to the political will to actually do their job instead of, kind of just going back and forth in some of these hearings that maybe are entertaining for social media, but aren't really the job of the legislature to codify some of these executive orders. I mean, in a perfect world, as we are now, a little bit into the 119th Congress, what should they prioritize in terms of legislation that would hopefully help block some of these attempts by the overreaching judiciary that could more easily say, oh, well, we're just blocking an executive order, but it's a little more difficult when it's gone all the way through the legislature?
Yeah, well, the problem is that if you were to create sort of an executive order omnibus, if you will, that you would put all these executive orders into a package, if you were to get it through the House, which, I think that itself, with the thin margins there and the different coalitions within the Republican Party there, would itself probably be difficult. But let's say you were able to do that, you're still stuck with the 60-member threshold for the filibuster. I do think there's a valid point to be made about perhaps the Senate codifying the filibuster into law, to prevent it from being busted in the future. There's this very dangerous game theory dynamic where you're going to have first mover advantage to abolishing the filibuster if it is not elevated beyond simply traditional norms there, and whoever is the first one to do that is going to have a major, major win. So if the Democrats are not willing to codify that, then what does that mean in terms of this environment? I think that's a very real question that should be asked and considered there. So eventually what you're going to have is what can be stapled onto, you know, a budget bill that doesn't have the same threshold in the Senate, and how many of these executive orders could you justify in that? In theory, a lot of the DOGE cuts and things like that could get worked into something like that. But again, unfortunately, we've seen that the appetite for many of the Republican legislators who love to campaign on fiscal responsibility and love to talk about DOGE and get photo ops with Elon Musk do not really have that great of a desire to put those cuts into practice, because every special interest group, every piece of cronyism has a patron, has a legislative supporter, and many of them are in red states as much as blue states. So again, it's just this systemic problem where the American political system is always going to favor things that rob from us, that rack up our debt, that hurt and punish future generations at the expense of doing the necessary reforms needed to really get the American economy where it needs to be. And the only thing, the biggest thing that is benefiting us right now, the reason why the American economy is as strong as it is right now, is because all of our other opponents, all of our other rivals, I don't want to necessarily say them opponents, but you know, ranging from Europe to China to et cetera, a lot of them have the same ideological problems that we do when it comes to the economy: overregulation, overspending, over debt. And so America's economy, our strength relies upon our relative metrics compared to other states. We are still relatively one of the best place to do business, given our size, you know, leaving some little loopholes states out there on the margins there. And so, you know, are we okay with simply being relatively good? What risk do we have of of the EU getting it shipped, getting its stuff together, and you're righting its ship and embracing some of that free market reforms? Probably not really likely, right? So that gives us a little bit of leeway here. But if we really want to have an American revival and a golden age, we have to go beyond simply being better than the rest, and we have to pursue policies that are actually good. And again, a lot of what we've heard from the Trump administration on the campaign trail are really good, really radical in some ways, but really American, really kind of foundational viewpoints in terms of the proper relationship between taxpayers and the state. Until we have a government that is willing to actually operate on that, then we're going to continue to be paying the price.
And you're so right, though, Bishop, that so many, unfortunately, of the conservatives in office want to have more of, you know, the photo ops and all of the other trappings that come along with being in Congress. They don't actually want to govern. And I think that's the biggest problem. And I don't really understand why we need to just, you know, reach across the aisle and, you know, all these things. I mean, you can't really collaborate with people who actually are not approaching the country in good faith, and certainly not their job. So, you know, when we have the Republican trifecta, let's move forward. And obviously, a filibuster-proof majority would be nice, and that's the obstacle, of course, in the Senate. But at least move forward, and maybe you have to make some of those concessions in the Senate, but certainly not in the House if everyone was on board, and that becomes mainly the problem. But just in the last few minutes we have here today, for people who are very interested in this and the economy, and this is a source of, you know, both excitement but maybe some frustration that, you know, we're 2 months in and they want to see Trump accomplish all of this. What is the best way for the average citizen to engage on these issues?
Well, one of the best ways is simply staying informed. And really, you know, I think this has a long payout, but it's educating your kids and your younger family members about the economy. That's not going to have a direct impact on, you know, the what the House is going to do in the short run. But a lot of the problems we have is that what good economics teaches you is who is ripping us off. And the state is the biggest predator out there. And so high school, your traditional government school economics class is not taught particularly well. You learn how to do supply and demand charts and things like that, which, you know, there's value to that, but it's not going to teach you this real dynamic of the productive sector versus the predatory sector, which is the real dynamic of government versus free markets. And so, you know, educating younger generations and creating that lens, because if you have that lens and all of a sudden you hear Green New Deal proposals or whatever Bernie Sanders or ARC is running with, you can sort of start poking holes in their underlying logic. And so that's what the Mises Institute does, is it focuses a great deal on that educational dynamic. In the meantime, you know, I would say, you know, call your congressman up and tell them to vote the right way. You know, I'm skeptical of them, of that, unfortunately, given how disconnected most of Congress is from the average citizen. But at the very least, what we can do is educate ourselves, educate our children, educate our neighbors, our civic clubs, so that they understand the proper view of the economy. Because then if you understand the proper view of the economy, it gives you a better idea for the proper view of the state.
Well said, as always, though, Bishop. And that's why I appreciate your comprehensive analysis and your perspective on this, and always giving us really good insights into the economy and what's going on more broadly than just the talking points and what conservatives want to see, but, you know, some of the practical realities on this. And so you can follow Tho Bishop and read everything that he writes at Tho, T-H-O, Bishop on X, and also at the Mises Institute. And as always, for these deep dives, we tend to pick our topics based on not only what's trending and what's being talked about in media, but what our listeners want to hear from. So if you have a topic, a question, or a guest, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net, and let us know what you would like to hear here on Demand. And we will drop the next episode on Friday, so it's every Fridays. And if you missed past episodes, like last week with Michael Knowles, great commentary, even further deep dive on the judiciary and the problems there, you can go to AFR.net. Click on that icon for podcast, same way that you found this one. And you can find the entire repository of all of the great episodes on Demand.